Hello there, Gretchen Miller with you, and welcome to summer here on Into the Music on RN, and we're bringing you the best of our programs from the past year. Now, it's the 51st anniversary of a very well-known British TV series theme, and you may have already guessed it, the iconic electronic-sounding Doctor Who theme. First created in 1963, as we all know, it lives on today on our TV screens, albeit slightly less electronic than back in those early days. The theme was created in the BBC Electronic Workshop that had been set up some years earlier, and it's credited as being probably the first electronic music theme tune used on TV, and easily it's the most recognisable. And yet, when it was made, not a single synthesiser had been invented. How it was made is described here in a blog by Mark Ayres.
Each note was individually created by cutting, splicing, speeding up or slowing down segments of analogue tape containing recordings of a single plucked string or white noise or tones from oscillators, which were used for calibrating equipment and rooms in the BBC and not for creating music. The swooping melody and lower bassline layer were created by manually adjusting the pitch of oscillator banks to a carefully timed pattern. The non-swooping parts of the melody were created by playing a keyboard attached to the oscillator banks. The rhythmic hissing sounds, the bubbles and clouds, were created by cutting tape recordings of filtered white noise.
And most of this work was done by one of a group of young women who worked in the workshop, and her name was Delia Derbyshire. Today's feature, that Doctor Who sound presented by Robbie Buck, was made to celebrate the Doctor's 50th birthday last year. It starts with musician Bill Drummond's fabulous recollections of that theme tune.
Boys, did you watch Doctor Who last night? This was late November 1963. I was the only boy in the Sunday school who hadn't. I was 11 years old and I had missed the first episode of Doctor Who forever. The next Saturday evening, I was sat in front of the family TV set in good time. The music and swirling visuals opening sequence started. What kind of music was this? What was happening to the TV screen? I have no memory of the actual plot or characters. Were there Daleks? I have no idea. But the first few seconds of the introduction to Doctor Who flung open my personal doors of perception wider than any acid trip in later life.
Bill Drummond, founding member of the UK outfit, the KLF, and one of thousands of musicians and other creative people who've been influenced by Doctor Who and the music created within the walls of the BBC's Radiophonic Workshop. A small unit put together in 1958 to provide BBC radio and television with special sound effects and atmospheric music. They were given a home in an old 1930s roller skating rink, which had been turned into an orchestral studio for the BBC in the London suburb of Maida Vale. Although the actual Doctor Who theme was written by an Australian composer living in London at that time, Ron Grainer, it was the iconic Delia Derbyshire, an early member of the workshop with help from sound effects designer Dick Mills, who transformed it into one of the world's most recognisable themes, using no more than a collection of clunky tone generators and magnetic tape, cut together in an incredibly painstaking process. You'll hear more about Delia later and the remarkable number of women in the Radiophonic Workshop during the 60s.
The Radiophonic Workshop had a very unusual sound world. and they brought it to the British public on primetime television shows like Doctor Who. The Doctor Who theme tune is a particularly avant-garde construction, and it was by far the most popularly heard piece of music concrete that had existed to date.
Adam Harper, a writer and musicologist at Oxford University. The Radiophonic Workshop had a great ability to work with very limited means. Much of their equipment at the very beginning was salvaged from around the BBC, bits and pieces that nobody else wanted. They built their own mixing desks, effects units, and recorded the sounds of everyday objects like lampshades, fire extinguishers, and water-filled bottles that were struck, stroked, and poured. But despite this experimental nature, they always managed to come up with something that was interesting to their audience. Not just otherworldly, science fiction sounds, but also highly melodic pieces of music. As their work became better known around the BBC, their budget increased, and from the late 60s, they were able to invest in the early modular synthesizers, like the VCS3 and the Synthi 100, both built by the English company EMS. The Doctor Who theme would be regularly spruced up by the workshop, usually at the start of a new season. And as most fans will know, there have also been major revisions, like this one here by Peter Howell in 1980. The 80s would see another major change, with the introduction of digital samplers, like the Australian-invented Fairlight CMI and Apple Macintosh computers set up with MIDI. At one point, the Radiophonic Workshop was considered to have some of the most expensive studios in Europe in terms of new equipment. But as Britain moved into a new financial age towards the end of the 80s, the workshop became too costly to maintain and slowly shrank, until it finally closed its doors in 1997. Their 39 years of creating music did, however, leave a weighty legacy. Chances are you would have heard some of their unusual work, not only in the United Kingdom, but in Commonwealth countries like Australia, Canada, and New Zealand, as well as the US and even Latin American countries. In Mexico and Venezuela, Doctor Who was known as Dr. Mysterioso. Adam Harper.
The Radiophonic Workshop were the first people to use synthesizers in Britain. And they not only used them, but they used them publicly. And they used them on television and radio, and in quite strange ways. So they broke the ground. And it would be impossible, I think, for artists like John Fox and Gary Newman and all the other slightly harsher synth acts of the time not to have had a sense of what the Radiophonic Workshop laid down.
Often, people weren't aware of the origin of this unusual music. However, a few particularly keen ears did prick up and take notice. And over the years, many musicians have signalled a love of the Radiophonic Workshop by either reworking the Doctor Who theme, sampling the music of original members, or even writing song lyrics, like the Pet Shop Boys, with their song Radiophonic. One of the most recent music genres to draw inspiration from the workshop's unique sound has been that of the hauntology genre. In 2006, the British music critic Mark Fisher, writing under the pseudonym K-Punk, took a term coined by the French philosopher Jacques Derrida and applied it to a loose-knit genre of musicians who were making eerie music that evoked bygone eras. A play on the word ontology, hauntology, was the idea that failed political movements and philosophies of the past never quite die out, but live on to haunt our modern thinking. In regards to music, it points to certain artists who were looking into the past for forgotten fragments of their childhood and reincorporating them into a modern sound. The most famous of these has been the Ghost Box record label. Set up in 2004 by musician Jim Jupp and graphic designer Julian House, their releases are full of quotes from the likes of American writer H.P. Lovecraft, Eric von Daniken and Robert Anton Wilson. Their sound covers everything from children's television shows, frightening public information films, and slightly pagan folk songs in the spirit of the film The Wicker Man. One of their pivotal releases was the album From an Ancient Star by Jupp's own band, Bellbury Polly, which came out in 2009. This music, Seed Ships, is the final track on the album. Adam Harper wrote about the development of the hauntology genre on his blog, Rouge's Foam.
Ghostbox and Boards of Canada and lots of other artists that have been associated with hauntology are doing more than simply reliving the past through these kind of rose-tinted spectacles. To me, the key hauntology is this really obvious and quite crushing contradiction that comes out of the nostalgia. The idea that we can't truly remember the past, or that the past is fragmentary, or that the past has a failed idealism. That's much more interesting and much more politically active as a kind of nostalgia, and it's more than nostalgia than, say, X indie band who wants to sound like the Jesus and Mary Chain or some other 80s band. Hauntology reveals aspects of the music that were not really perceived in the first place, and by bringing things like crackle and some of the strange relationships within the music to our attention and exaggerating them in the present, in many ways it's a kind of music criticism for older music. So it can reveal things, and it can indeed be a new way of listening to old things.
This is Radio 1 and 2. The time is 7:30, news time.
Ghostbox have often said in interviews that the era of the radiophonic workshop they're most interested in is from 1958 to 1973, which means basically the music of people like Delia Derbyshire and John Baker. However, in the early 70s, new members joined the workshop, like Paddy Kingsland and Peter Howell. And to borrow a word from Doctor Who, they began to regenerate the sound of the workshop into something more contemporary. They were able to bridge the gap between the earlier music concrete techniques of the workshop into the more cosmic electronic sound of commercially available synthesizers, like the Arp Odyssey and the Yamaha CS80.
There was a feeling when I joined that I was actually the latest in a line of previous composers, some of whom had become very well known indeed. Delia Derbyshire had left about 18 months before I joined, but I met her many times, and she was kind about my version of Doctor Who, actually. There was still the feeling that the Radiophonic Workshop was the place where you made sounds that nobody'd heard before, which is a strange thing to say these days, because it's like, you know, everything is available to us. And in fact, we have the opposite problem of having so much available, we don't know where to start. But in those days, we were genuinely actually delivering sounds that people had never heard before. And that inevitably gave it a certain sort of mystique, I think. We were the only people working in electronic music who had tight deadlines. If you're working for a broadcaster, you inevitably have deadlines. And that also worked in our favor, because one of the things that happens when you don't have deadlines is that you overwork things. You become far too used to the sound that you're making and then go and look for another sound. So, in other words, a lot of our stuff was quite raw in a way. The ideas were very fresh, but the sound was sometimes quite raw, and that in itself, I think, was interesting to people.
One of Peter Howell's best-known pieces was called The Astronauts, which was actually used by the BBC in a number of different space-themed television documentaries throughout the 1970s, like Space for Man and The Case of the Ancient Astronauts.
The original idea for the title music for Space for Man was actually live musicians, because it had quite a big budget, because it was actually a European-wide sponsored program. And so I actually had a studio full of musicians, and I'd written a piece, and I actually conducted this piece. I think there were about 20 musicians. I can admit this now because of how many years afterwards it is, but to be quite honest, I didn't really like the result. They played it fine, I just wasn't very happy with what I'd written. And on the way upstairs back to the Radiophonic Workshop, I actually thought of something better. So I got back up to my studio and spent the rest of the night actually putting together something that was based on a random filtered bass feedback sound, which is that trundle sound underneath, is actually derived from that. And I worked on that all night and came up with what I thought was far more exciting. Delivered this electronic score to the director, who absolutely loved it and never realized that it wasn't the session. So he never asked for his money back. So that's fine.
The documentary, The Case of the Ancient Astronauts, had been a co-production between the BBC and America's Public Broadcasting Service, better known in the US as PBS, the home of Sesame Street. But this wasn't the only area of American programming that the BBC was making inroads into.
Hello, Doctor. We've been waiting for you.
Doctor Who's double is far better looking than most of his enemies. He battles an intergalactic rogues gallery of witches, giant insect men, space troopers, even adversaries that are half-human, half-machine. Join Doctor Who on his crime-fighting missions against the tyrants of the universe.
Watch for Doctor Who tomorrow afternoon at 3.
The success of Star Wars in 1977 had led to a boom in science fiction. And though Doctor Who had played sporadically in the past, PBS bought all of the new series in 1978. New science fiction magazines like Starlog started covering the series in greater detail, as well as advertising Doctor Who merchandise. Someone who closely watched these developments was Lewis Niebuhr, the author of a fantastic history of the Radiophonic Workshop called Special Sound. He's also an associate professor of musicology at the University of Nevada. He describes what life was like for an American fan of Doctor Who growing up in the 1980s.
I grew up in Kansas City, and Kansas City Public Television had a very active Doctor Who community. So they started showing Doctor Who in the late 70s and quickly became established throughout most of America as a Friday night 10:30 thing. And PBS stations kind of counted on having Doctor Who at 10:30 at night, showing in the movie format, that omnibus format of compiling all the episodes together. I'm not alone in saying that Doctor Who became the kind of thing that you planned on every week, every Friday night. You have sleepovers with your friends would come over, and you get to stay up late and watch Doctor Who. It was only the Tom Baker stories. Tom Baker stories on an endless loop, over and over and over again. And then they finally showed Legopolis, and then started showing the Peter Davison episodes on an endless loop. And about halfway through the Davison run, they started showing old episodes of First, Second, and Third Doctors. And that was just a revelation. Everyone I know had only ever seen pictures of these Doctors in things like in Doctor Who magazine or in The Five Doctors. I think it was a convergence of a few interests of mine. You know, when I was a kid, it was all about Doctor Who and Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and I knew what the Radiophonic Workshop was then. In fact, the first record I remember ever getting was the Genesis of the Daleks LP, came with the sound effects album, and then Doctor Who the music. Oh, and then of course it came with the 45 with Tom Baker on the cover of the Doctor Who theme, backed with the Astronauts. And so I got those records, and I remember playing them I played them nonstop through my childhood, through my adolescence, I guess, 10, 11, 12, 13 years old. So there was that. And then when I went to school for music, I studied music as an undergrad at the University of Iowa, and realized pretty quickly I wanted to go into musicology, and I had no idea what I wanted to study, but I was really attracted to English musical Renaissance period, you know, Vaughan Williams, up to Benjamin Britten, that sort of thing. And I think eventually all these interests kind of coalesced together I knew it was gonna be something British, then something electronic. I think once I acknowledged that there was no shame in my nerdiness, I let myself write about the workshop.
Don't you realize how dangerous it is to intercept a transmat beam?
Oh, come, Doctor, not with our techniques. We Time Lords transcended such simple mechanical devices when the universe was less than half its present size.
Besides an audio clip from Genesis of the Daleks, you're also hearing a classic Model 500 Detroit techno track called Night Drive, Time Space Transmat. With a sample by Rick Davis, the word transmat would be picked up by Derek May to form a label of the same name, which would be a major influence on European techno in the early 90s. The actual transmat was, in fact, a teleportation device from Doctor Who that reoccurred through a number of stories. This may not have been a direct influence of the workshop, but it does show how the presence of Doctor Who on television filtered down and impacted on the creative work of its viewers and a whole new generation of musicians. Now, rave, techno, drum and bass and dubstep, you name it, anything slightly electronic has always been considered the domain of men, young guys dabbling with equipment. But one of the great truths about the Radiophonic Workshop was that many of its early pioneers were in fact female. Besides Daphne Oram, who co-founded the workshop with Desmond Briscoe, and the already mentioned Derbyshire, there was Glynis Jones, who worked on Doctor Who, Elizabeth Parker, who composed the score for David Attenborough's Life on Earth, as well as Maddalena Fagandini, who had one of her many rhythmic interval signals reworked by future Beatles producer George Martin into this novelty track called Time Beat. However, by creating the Doctor Who theme, it was indeed Delia who became the workshop's most recognisable member. Delia had studied maths and music at Cambridge University and first joined the BBC as a studio manager at Broadcast House. During her days off, she'd sit in and watch workshop members in action, subsequently organising a transfer and staying with them for 11 years.
She had an outgoing personality and became very active outside of the BBC in the second half of the 60s, forming the group Unit Delta Plus with future EMS founder Peter Zinoviev and workshop colleague Brian Hodgson, who was responsible for two of the most iconic Doctor Who sounds, the sound of the Daleks and the sound of the TARDIS. Unit Delta Plus also gave lectures and performed at many of the early psychedelic events, including the Million Volt Sound and Light Rave at the Roundhouse in 1967. Although Delia passed away in 2001, she's left an enduring legacy in both her music and her life. In 2013, a trio of female musicians and artists known as the Delia Darlings spent 2 weeks sifting through her archives at the University of Manchester. They followed this with a series of performances commemorating her work with their own compositions. Caroline Churchill, aka Caro C, describes how this project came about.
Well, I actually first found out about her via MySpace, and instantly I was like, wow, okay, this woman is not of now. From the picture, it looked quite dated, 60s, 70s. So yeah, I was quite curious really, and then sort of discovered her and Daphne Oram and their music, and wow, just thought, so often I'm pigeonholed into this, oh, you're a woman doing electronic music. And I think realising that there was these four mothers doing really out there stuff, but also really on it, you know, technically, and so creative, and yet it was in the mainstream as well. I think that's something that really struck me, and the diversity of their work. I think I was humbled pretty quickly, really, and also this isolated, strange female happening to be doing technology stuff. It's like, okay, there's a context here, there's a history. You know, women have been making this music, and that's how I think I first started to realise that there are more women in the history of electronic music than are more prevalent, if you like.
Any sound can be made into a radiophonic sound by the treatment it receives. The sort of sounds we usually use are electronic sounds of various sorts, and also sounds that are recorded, picked up by a microphone, everyday sounds, and also musical instruments. All these are sources of sound.
And moved to Manchester in about 2007, and it was working at one of the music festivals here that someone said to me, oh, you do realise that the archives of the godmother of electronic music are here in Manchester, to which my answer was no and wow. So yeah, I was just very interested to obviously get an insight into her work and the expanse of her work and also her working methods, and just thought, wow, there has to be, you know, an interesting project in there which hasn't really been done yet in Manchester. So that's with the seeds of that. I think for me it was quite important that it was female artists, at least to start with, that are responding to her work. And I also felt that she's not just an electronic composer. She's a music sound poetry, you could say, as well. So I felt that different angles on her work to show, you know, just how broad she was in her skills and her creativity would be interesting to get sort of quite distinctive female artists. So I thought of Naomi Kashiwagi. She's really a visual artist, actually, but she likes to use sound as well, and she's done things like a typewriter orchestra. And at the moment, she's quite into using gramophones and creating live glitching loops with it. And then Eilish Nirian, who's a very interesting and quite experimental contemporary classical composer. And I thought she would give an interesting sort of insight into Delia's, you know, musical, technical expertise and knowledge as well. I think looking at Delia and Daphne, especially Daphne Oram, who set up the Radiophonic Workshop, if you look at the social context of women at that time, I mean, I know, you know, they sound quite upper middle class at least, and that's mainly, I think, because that was a BBC accent or way of speaking. But, you know, Delia describes herself as working class, and the fact that they obviously carved out their own path and defied a lot of conventions in those days for women, let alone generally. And I think they really tapped into something that was their own voice, their own creativity, while also, again, serving the needs of radio and TV. I think I just love how you can't put her in a particular box, you know, and I think there's a part of me that thought she must have had quite a hard life for being who she was, and she really did dare to be rare, you know. And I think that deserves a lot of respect, and apparently she said she didn't get the recognition, you know, she felt she deserved. And I think it's really nice how with time she is getting that recognition, I hope, and more people seem to be really respecting with the context of time that, wow, they did this, you know, they did this at a time when you had to actually cut things physically and you couldn't undo something 32 times, that I hope she'll gain more and more respect for her work, really.
But it wasn't only electronic music that was influenced by the Radiophonic Workshop. Right back during the 60s, rock bands were also very curious about these strange sounds emanating from behind the walls of the BBC. A few very well-known musicians did come and visit the workshop, like Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones, who Delia later recalled played around with the equipment in his trademark frilly-sleeved shirt. However, some of the most important visitors to the workshop, just months after the infamous Summer of Love, were the members of the psychedelic rock band Pink Floyd. Pink Floyd at that point was still very underground, having regularly played at many of London's psychedelic clubs. However, they were on the cusp of much greater success and would be championed by the famous British DJ John Peel. After showing them around the workshop, Delia organised for Pink Floyd to go and visit Peter Zinoviev's studio, which had been the home of Unit Delta Plus. Although Peter hadn't officially set up EMS yet, this introduction marked the beginning of an ongoing relationship between EMS and Pink Floyd. Pink Floyd would become their most famous customer, the trademark EMS sound heard on many of their famous albums, like here in On the Run, from their very successful 1973 album, Dark Side of the Moon. But not only were Pink Floyd sharing the same sound palette as the workshop, they would also quote the Doctor Who theme in One of These Days, from their 1971 album, Metal. It was buried very low in the mix, and so became something that mystified fans for years. For it would often disappear and then reappear, and then disappear again from their live performances. However, here, in a recording from their 1994 Pulse tour, live at Earl's Court, there could be no mistaking it. They brought it directly into the foreground, confirming to anyone who'd ever had any doubt that this was indeed a riff from Doctor Who. But if that wasn't enough, there's also a third and final connection between Pink Floyd and the BBC Radiophonic Workshop that is perhaps the most intriguing, involving the band's iconic founding member, the charismatic Syd Barrett. In the 1950s, before Doctor Who, there was another science fiction character roaming the English countryside, looking at supernatural phenomena from a purely scientific point of view. What seemed to be the presence of ghosts and the paranormal would often turn out to be no more than visitors from outer space.
While the mysterious hull found in the pit at Knightsbridge is being investigated by Professor Quatermass and his colleagues, a black magic pentacle is discovered inside it, and a terrified sapper sees a dwarf-like figure pass through the wall.
Sid was among the 12 million viewers who tuned in to watch the third Quatermass story, Quatermass and the Pit, over the Christmas break in 1958. An epic event in the UK that rendered telephone exchanges dead for the duration of the show, while its audience watched on in horror. The story involved the discovery of a spaceship, thought to be a leftover bomb from World War II, which is accidentally unearthed in a building site in a reportedly haunted area of London known as Hobbs Lane.
Alarming noises and spectral appearances. September 1762.
Our informant further states that grievous sounds emanating from the very earth have so affrighted certain fellows employed in the digging of a well that one is like to die mad.
Digging a well? Do any of the others mention that?
Not that I've noticed.
The Radiophonic Workshop had arrived just in time for this third Quatermass story, and it would mark their first foray into television. The workshop's co-founder, Desmond Briscoe, was tasked with coming up with a special sound effect for the climax of the film, when psychic activity from the ship starts to affect everyone and everything around it, and inanimate objects like electrical cables would begin to come to life. Sid was 12 at the time Quatermass played, an impressionable age, and he'd later say that watching Quatermass had been a big part of the reason he'd developed an interest in space and science fiction. Through his live playing at the UFO Club, he developed an experimental sound involving lots of feedback and long, winding instrumental passages that would become a trademark of Pink Floyd's music. Though Sid was to sadly leave Pink Floyd due to ill health not long after the release of their first album in 1967, he is still regarded to this day as a true pioneer of the psychedelic sound. Feedback always played a special role within the workshop, known within the BBC by the old-fashioned term howl round, which describes the circular path a sound takes when it travels out of a speaker and back into itself via a microphone, creating that screeching sound we call feedback. Interestingly, the term also applied to a similar visual effect created by pointing a camera at a monitor, which was how the opening swirls of Doctor Who were first created. Tapping directly into this heritage is a current studio manager within the BBC World Service. Robin Warren, a.k.a. Robin the Fog, also known as Howl Round, who in July 2012 released a special tribute album, Ghosts of Bush, to commemorate Bush House as part of a consolidation plan within the BBC.
BBC Radio Nottingham coming up to 29 minutes past 6, update on the headlines of latest travel. But here's a weird thing. This is weird. This is just weird. Because I've been saying, can a building be musical by and of itself? Well, according to the person who made an album, and the details I'll give to you later on. A building does have an inherent musicality, and this is the living proof. By recording the strange croaks and creaks and groans and graunches of an iconic building in London, and then taking those sounds and using analogue tape to manipulate them, I think Robin Warren, the man behind this, has come up with an intriguing sound. I'll tell you more about this, which building it was, and indeed how you can get hold of a digital download of the album that features those noises in the next quarter of an hour. It's weird, I know, but it's kind of haunting, grabs you, I think.
Bush House had been the home to the World Service for over 70 years. So, leading up to its closure, Robin Warren spent many nights recording nocturnal creakings and echoes within the halls of the building, mixing the final product down in the building's reportedly haunted basement onto two elderly reel-to-reel tape machines. Wow.
The reason I wanted to make a tribute to Bush House is that it was a building that so many people loved, including myself. I mean, even before I worked for the BBC, even going past it, it's got this sort of incredible dignity to it. It's got this very impressive facade. It was a great sadness that many people felt in leaving the building, that many of them had worked in for 30 or 40 years, perhaps. The strict rule I imposed upon myself was that every sound had to be a natural sound of the building that was already there, and it had to be produced using equipment that was at my disposal and that I would use in my everyday work as a studio manager. So we had two reel-to-reel tape machines that were literally just lying around in the basement. They'd been decommissioned. And I went around the building at night recording different sounds with a handheld digital recorder. The first recording I made, it was at 3 a.m, and I was just using a mobile phone, and I recorded myself whistling some distance from the phone in the stairwell, and it had this amazing high ceiling and these Portland stone walls, which are very resonant, dubbed it onto tape at 15 inches per second, and then played it back at 7.5 inches a second. And suddenly, you know, instead of my sort of really out of tune whistling, you get this kind of ethereal choir sound just from that one recording of whistling in a stairwell. So I thought, well, I'm onto something here. There's no computer effects, there's no artificial reverb, there's nothing added. I didn't want to have anything added that wasn't already there. So we use a little bit of tape echo, but that's just created by feeding the sound back into itself. So there's nothing that you're hearing that wasn't part of the building already. It's just maybe it needed teasing out a bit. I'd had one night where absolutely nothing was going right at all, and I was about to just give it up and go home. Everything was just sounding like a sludgy old mess. And then one of the other studio managers came down. She was on a night shift, and she said, "What are you doing down here?" And I played her a couple of things I've been working on, and she was fantastically enthusiastic. And I thought, well, I'll give it another half hour and see what happens. And half an hour later, I was sitting with a rough version of the track Cold Space and Peeling Oxide, which I actually think is probably my favourite part of the album. And I was just sitting there going, where on earth did this come from? And if you played it back to me now, I still wouldn't be able to tell you what those sounds are. I think there's a door handle involved in there somewhere. From absolutely nothing and from just being fed up and frustrated, within the space of half an hour, this kind of, I think one of the best things I've ever done, just suddenly in half an hour, just happened. And I can't really account for it.
Just as Robin was putting the final touches on his Ghost of Bush album, an account started on Twitter announcing the formation of a new radiophonic workshop. But this time, it was not a work venture, but a virtual art space, a collaboration between the BBC and the Arts Council of England, under the leadership of experimental electronic musician Matthew Herbert. It was, perhaps in part, a realisation that the radiophonic workshop had attained a near-mythical place within the English cultural landscape. And despite being closed for over 15 years, the memory of this seminal electronic workshop is alive and very well. As are the members of the original workshop themselves, who've started getting invites to perform at English music festivals. These two developments are a great recognition of the workshop's special place in electronic music history, their role in developing and nurturing a future full of electronic music, from the synth pop of the very early 80s to rave and techno in the 90s, from trip hop to dubstep and the more offbeat genres like Hauntology. But the question is, how can a new generation of electronic musicians distinguish themselves in an age full of electronic music, when sometimes a ringtone can sound just as good as anything that previous generations have created? They may not be making music in exactly the same way. However, they are tapping into the spirit of the workshop in its inventiveness, innovating on existing sounds by utilising the do-it-yourself tradition with equipment and in finding what ways they can to bend the latest technologies for their own musical discoveries. So, thank you, Radiophonic Workshop. And thank you, Doctor Who.
The Pet Shop Boys with Dalek, I Love You, their homage to Doctor Who. And the feature today, That Doctor Who Sound, was written and produced by Ian Wilson and presented by Robbie Buck. Sound engineers were Mark Don and Louis Mitchell, and the executive producer was Kathy Peters. And you can download this program or listen again online via the Into the Music website. To take us out this week, we've created an audio montage of a rare BBC radiophonic work made in 1957, just 1 year before the workshop was established. It was made by Frederick Bradnam and Daphne Oram and produced by Donald McWhinney.
1, 2, 3, 4.
The BBC presents Private Dreams and Public Nightmares, a radiophonic poem by Frederick Bradnam. The programme is introduced by the producer, listen, Donald McWhinney.
Listen. Listen with your inner ear. 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20.
This program is an experiment, an exploration. It's been put together with enormous enthusiasm and equipment designed for other purposes. The basis of it is an unlimited supply of magnetic tape, a recording machine, a razor blade, and something to stick the bits together with, and a group of technicians who think nothing is too much trouble provided it works. You take a sound, any sound, record it, and then
change its nature
by a multiplicity of operations. You record it at different speeds, you play it backwards, you add it to itself over and over again. You adjust filters, echoes, acoustic qualities, you combine segments of magnetic tape. By these means and many others, you can create sounds which no one has ever heard before. Sounds which have an indefinable and unique quality of their own. You can compose a vast and subtle symphony from the noise of a pin dropping. In fact, one of the most vibrant and elemental sounding noises in tonight's programme started life as an extremely tinny cowbell.
Round and round like a wind from the ground, beat
It's a sort of modern magic. Many of you may be familiar with it. They've been exploiting it on the continent for years. But strangely enough, we've held aloof, partly through distrust. Is it simply a new toy? Partly through complacency, ignorance too. We're saying at last that we think there's something in it. But we aren't calling it musique concrète. In fact, we've decided not to use the word music at all. Some musicians believe that it can become an art form complete in itself. Others are sceptical. That's not our immediate concern.
The image smashes. Here, it smashes because you fear.
We are interested in its application to radio writing, dramatic or poetic, adding a new dimension. A form which is essentially radio. Properly used, radiophonic effects have no near relationship with any existing sound. They're free of irrelevant associations. They have an emotional life of their own. And they could be a new and invaluable strand in the texture of radio, and theatre, and cinema, and television.
Walking on water between floating briefcases, umbrellas and drowned faces.
My friends, you have learnt to be my enemy.
Frederick Bradnam has given us a text specifically designed to exploit some of these new sounds and dependent on them for full effect.
A way out. I must find the door.
There is no way out provided. Each corridor leads into another corridor.
I must find the door, the open door.
Every sound you hear in this program is a new one, and has been specially made. Each voice has been specially treated. We can now, by technical means, achieve emotional effects with the human voice as a basis, quite different from anything the actor can do on his own. And the program has been put together inch by inch. Not to prove how clever we are, but because we believe that radio hasn't exhausted itself. The subtitle is a radiophonic poem. We believe that such an art form may exist, quite distinct from the poem on the page or the poem read aloud. A poetic experience which only exists in terms of a sound complex.
In the world that I inhabit daily, bowler hatted, I pay my taxes and concerned about the size of armies, the hunger in continents, the measurements of actresses. In the world beyond this, the atom bomb teaches me respect for the scientists.
And the program isn't a model. It simply tries to indicate the sort of possibilities that are within reach. And I'm not suggesting that your ears should now be bombarded by programs of this kind. There are any number of ways of using these new techniques. They've already been applied in a modest way in thrillers and science fiction plays. Indeed, the broad effects are the easiest to achieve. Horror, hysterical comedy. It's much more difficult to manage tenderness, lyrical beauty, sweetness and light. Perhaps because of the inhuman element in the actual process of manufacture. But I do believe that many writers will find an imaginative stimulus in this demonstration of a new mode of expression, a new adjunct to the spoken word. And as we learn more and improve our equipment, the possibilities will increase. One thought does occur from time to time, not entirely frivolously. Would it not be more illuminating to play the whole thing backwards?
Just a sample there from the 1957 radiophonic production Private Dreams and Public Nightmares, remixed by Louis Mitchell for Into the Music. Next week, we're going backstage at the Australian production of The Lion King. We talk costumes, stage sets, and the lives and dreams of the magnificent performers. I'm Gretchen Miller. This has been Into the Music. See you next week.